friends and new and regular listeners, a warm welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik and this is Internet Talk Radio, recorded from the west coast of Sweden. Thank you for tuning in, very nice to have you along here today. On Thursdays and Sundays, we are here highlighting research and information for your consideration. Our website is redicecreations.com. Stop by for frequently updated news, links, resources, videos, our member section, the forums, and much more. And today on the program, we have Ian Crane back with us on the show. We first had Ian with us back in May, talking about Codex Alimentarius and the New World Order's quest for Sion in 2012. About 2 weeks after that, we had the young man Rick Clay with us, talking about a similar topic, connecting many threads about 2012, the London Olympics, Sion, Project Blue Beam, and Prince William, and much more. And I also think that Rick and Ian corresponded a little bit back and forth around that same time. And as you probably know right now, as you were listening to this program, you probably know that Rick Clay is dead. He has left us. He has passed away. And myself and Ian are going to talk a little bit about this here today. We're going to talk about Rick Clay at the beginning of the program and talk about what we know happened so far and the importance of integration, if you will, of information and these kinds of topic, how to deal with information and how this is relating to your own perception in a way and if there's some kind of lesson, if you will, that we can learn from this and take with us and hopefully prevent this in a way from happening again and so forth. It's very important and I think it's important also to recognize that something can be learned out of this horrific event here. And we waited commenting on Rick Clay's death on this show simply because we have not been able to get a hold of someone close to Rick that could tell us what has happened, and we didn't want to spur on these rumors and assertions that surfaced and floated around on the web that Rick was murdered. We felt that there was no reason to start speculating. Instead, we wanted to kind of wait and let this sink in until we could reach someone close to Rick that could tell us something that we could go on and bring forward or mention further to you guys about what happened and so forth. We also waited to comment on this out of respect for Rick's family and his friends, of course, to leave some room and some time to let this sink in, to let some breathing space here for his family before sending like 300 emails and demanding answers about whatever. But some people just can't seem to let this sink in and have a bloody rest before starting to speculate and consequently then knowing at that point with 100% certainty what has happened. Although they never met Rick or never talked to him, they're like hovering vultures waiting to almost pick the bones, if you will, and get a piece of the action without realizing that what has happened has now happened, and no matter how much we speculate, it won't bring Rick back. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't ask questions. Of course we should. This is very healthy. I think it's a good sign of concern about each other, a sign that people care. Asking questions and wanting to find out is a key aspect of all of this. But to make assertions and coming to premature conclusions and then blabbering out these ideas and theories as absolute facts or absolute proof that this has happened, that's another another thing here. So anyway, today on Thursday, September the 11th, 2008, Rick Clay's ashes will be scattered, or has been scattered actually at this time that we're doing this program. And what we've been able to make of the situation so far after speaking to a very, very close friend of Rick's yesterday, and I won't mention his or her name here today simply because I'm actually waiting on a yes or no if I can name this person and if I can fully share this story with you guys. I'm waiting for that confirmation, if you will, before I share everything with you here today. But what I've learned at this point then is that Rick decided to take his own life. Also, Daniel Tatman, a good friend and guest on this radio program, was in contact with Rick's mother just a short while ago. She also mentioned that Rick decided to take his own life. And I know that some people will have another opinion about this. That's fine. But I want to let you know that we have talked with two people close to Rick. And at this point, I don't see any proof at all that Rick was murdered. if I see proof that points in this direction, I will look at that point and reevaluate the situation. But that's not the case at this point. It needs to be mentioned also, of course, again, that paranoia goes hand in hand with conspiracy research. It's rampant. It comes with the territory in a way. And that's part of some people's journey as well. That's fine. We should also mention, of course, that just because you're paranoid, that doesn't mean that they aren't after you. And all of that kind of that context, murder do happens, absolutely. People like David Kelly comes to mind, suspicious murders. But in the case of David Kelly, there's something to go on, some kind of physical evidence, testimony or eyewitness inconsistencies. But so far, when it comes to Rick, I haven't heard or read anything that points in this direction. Nothing is there is no proof here, so to speak, that Rick was murdered. And some people might point to his mood, that he was very cheerful when we talked to him on the program, so therefore he couldn't have done it. But it's very easy to forget that there was a human being behind the research and behind the blog or the website. A human being that, just like all of us, is struggling with oneself, having doubts about themselves and the world, struggling with everyday issues, struggling with insecurity perhaps, and especially being into conspiracy research, just asking the questions, you know, shit, am I nuts to believe this stuff? Is this really going on? Am I losing it? Can it really be true? Kind of inner dialogue. So for me anyway, personally, I will always leave room for the possibility that I might be wrong. So for me to make assertions with that kind of 100% certainty without any kind of evidence, that's not rational. And you who are listening to this have the right to believe whatever you want to believe, obviously. But I'm upset about the fact that when people assert that this was murder, it to me takes away the fact that there was a human being and a personality behind the research, a person who, just like us at times, are struggling with ourselves, the world, and everything that is going on. And just because, as I said, Rick was full of energy, sounded upbeat and positive on the radio programs we did with him, does that mean that he couldn't have changed, that he couldn't have doubts about himself, about what he was into, about his discoveries? We don't know how he might have reacted by hearing 4 hours on himself, of himself and his own research coming back to him, so to speak. It might have sounded strange to him. It might have not have come out the way he wanted to. Or it could be something else, nothing to do with the radio program we did with him, but from the attention and the overall feedback via his blog that kind of was momentously building in a way. I don't know. But shouldn't we recognize that there is a human being behind all this that has his own psychology to deal with, his own responses and reactions? So in a nutshell, what Rick's friends relayed to me is that back in June, one evening under stress and extreme overthinking, he did lose his mind, and he wasn't ready to plunge into the depths that he did. And for 3 months after this event, he apparently was very far removed from himself. And on August the 28th, Rick decided to take his own life. And as I said, I won't read the entire account to you right here because of, as I said, out of respect for his friend, and I want to wait until I can get a yes or no, the permission, if you will, to read the entire message and potentially share that with you guys. So there you have it. At this point, this is what I have to go on, and until another story emerge or some other detail, whatever it might be, this is what we have to go on. I believe this, and I feel that this is the truth. I personally didn't know Rick all that well. We talked very briefly before the program we did, and very briefly afterwards. So I personally don't know what kind of person Rick was. He was very new into this kind of material. He went into it with 110% enthusiasm. He kind of moved so fast, so quickly into this. It's very, one reason. That was one reason that we wanted him back on the show as well, to do two programs in a row like that, because he was moving so fast, and there was kind of a rush, in a way, in his research, which is pretty interesting now when I'm thinking back of this again. But anyway, we tried to calm things down a bit and with that second Q&A program that we did. But with that being said, you know, awakening is a great thing. There's so much momentum and energy. The hunger for information is incredible, just as it should be. One should, one is connected to the muse in a way, and the information and ideas flows through you in a wonderful way. I think one should surf on the energy of that wave. But one needs to be careful not to be drawn down and into the abyss as well. So make up your own mind about this. You know, me personally, I don't think that he was murdered, as I've said and stated now. It's important to recognize that esoteric and hidden or occult information is a powerful thing, and conspiracy research is it's a powerful subject, and there have been people in the past that have been, you know, losing their minds on different levels because they can't handle it. One should never be afraid, of course, to investigate, to believe, or you know, have curiosity and an inquisitive mind about these things, but there needs to be a respect for the subject matter as well, a healthy kind of detachment from it all, and a healthy balance. One also needs to live one's life, and having a laugh, having a few drinks with some friends or whatever, go out into nature, play, create, paint, draw, have some fun, laugh, you know, disconnect from it all for a while. I think that that's vital to your mental health. It's so important for your personal balance. And I'm not saying that Rick didn't do all of these things, but people are very different. This is something that you have to feel for yourself. You have to know yourself. And I'm just saying that sitting in front of the black screen to the world, as it were, your computer monitor, the Palantir, as I call it sometimes, sitting in front of that and with that too much shaping your worldview solely through the information that is gained there, that might not be so great all the time for you. It's like anything, like watching too much TV. Many know that will make you go nuts in one way and psychologically weak, you know, in another. And I think that this shouldn't be solely the main source that dominates your life or shape all our opinions about the world. It all depends on where you look, of course, and what you're looking for. Some people might do fine with absorbing very much information all the time, but demands and pressure is a very powerful thing. So this was Rick's journey on this planet, this time around at least. I'm very proud to have been able to talk to Rick and be part of what he did and the information that he synthesized and brought forward. And I will miss him, although I didn't know him that well. I will miss him, definitely. So with that being said, now I want to hear from Ian Crane. I want to thank you for coming on back to the show, Ian, and thanks for letting me go through that introduction to this program and read that out. It was very important for me to do that and just kind of state my position, at least, on this. But, you know, with that, thank you for coming on, Ian. How are you?
Hi, Henrik. Hey, it's good to be back with you, although unfortunate timing for all the reasons you just stated, of course.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, I guess that you heard about this a while back as well, about Rick, and as I understand it, were you in contact with Rick yourself personally, or via email or something like that?
Actually, to answer your first question, I heard about this last Friday morning via an anonymous email. I mean, I don't follow the forums particularly. You know, I find that you can get bogged down in those and end up down a lot of blind alleys. But I received an anonymous email last Friday morning which advised me of Rick's death. And in fact, I invited the author of that email to call me, which he did. And, you know, he explained as much as he knew during the course of that phone conversation. And I did actually ask one of the moderators of the David Icke forum to post up my condolences to his family, because I mean, although I'm certainly of the mindset that you know, Rick has simply just moved to another place.
Yes.
You know, it's just the end of the physical vehicle, not the end of Rick Clay per se. But I asked to, you know, post the condolences to the family. I didn't actually have any email exchanges with Rick other than shortly after his blog appeared. He did write to me and acknowledge the fact that, you know, the springboard to his research had actually been attending my presentation at Glastonbury last year, the Fool Me Once presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote back to him and said, you know, good to hear from you, Rick. You know, please feel free to give me a call sometime. And I gave in the email, I gave my phone numbers. But unfortunately, I never heard from Rick. So apart from literally one email in each direction, there was no more contact than that.
Oh.
But I mean, I was very surprised to see Rick's blog pulled. I think it was the sort of sometime in June, because he, as you rightly say, he'd been on your program, I think, a week or two after I first came on.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously his blog attracted a lot of attention, and rightly so. There was some, you know, some very good stuff there. And when the blog disappeared, I must confess, I didn't suspect foul play at all. But I did actually suspect, that there may be a sort of, some reflection on Rick's part as to, the speed with which he was putting stuff out there, because, like you alluded to in your introduction, you know, this information, as we delve into, how should I say, the occult realm,
yes,
can come at us very thick and very fast, and our challenge is to integrate that information and use that knowledge wisely. And I liken the situation very much to my own awakening. I mean, I was a little bit older than Rick. In fact, arguably quite a bit older than Rick. I was in my late 30s when, the trigger went, and in my DNA and the Kundalini was awakened, and the universe decided to sort of kick my ass out of my sojourn in the corporate realm and force me to reflect on everything that I thought I knew. I still have. I mean, I have a pile here. I have probably close on 36 notebooks of all the stuff that was flooding at me in a period. Actually, those 36 notebooks span a period of about 3 years, so it's roughly one a month that I was filling. And this information, I mean, what I took it as was pieces of a jigsaw. The only problem was I didn't have the picture.
Yes.
And, so the pieces of the jigsaw didn't actually make any sense to me at the time, although they were all very interesting pieces. And my work, if you like, over the last decade has been to try and put those pieces into the picture. And some I have, and many I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the pieces of jigsaw I've incorporated into the work that I've put out over the last few years. And there's other pieces of the jigsaw that are still waiting to find their place in the bigger picture. And I'm sure over time I will find where they fit in. And I think this is how should I say, the nature of the beast. And I am absolutely understand why it was that Rick felt he wanted to immerse himself into, studying down this particular avenue, because it is exciting, it's stimulating, and you feel as though you're really onto something revolutionary, as well as revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, what was interesting re-listening to Rick's interviews. I mean, although he does reference a few people. Has obviously checked on to support his own findings. I mean, a lot of it has obviously come to him directly.
Yeah.
Now, how that came to him directly at this juncture, we don't know. I mean, I will make absolutely no bones about it, but a lot of my insights came whilst I was, let me put this tactfully, in the shamanic realms.
All right. Gotcha.
Okay.
Yes.
And consequently, one brings information back from the shamanic realms. Some of it is junk, and some of it is useful. And obviously, what we have to do is we have to practice the art of discretion and discernment and filtering, and then decide, how it is that we're going to put it out there.
Yes.
And I think, just like David Icke, I have to say that David Icke taught me a amazing lesson. And I'm sure he taught many people an amazing lesson, because back in the early 90s, when he had his revelationary moment, he felt this absolute need to sort of get out there and broadcast it.
Yes.
And, as he will admit himself, the turquoise shell suit moment on the Wogan show wasn't his finest hour.
Right.
And tragically, he took he's still probably even to this day, trying to sort of overcome, if you like, the negative reaction that moment caused. But the lesson for me was, don't stick your head above the parapet until you're comfortable, with what it is you're going to present and the way in which you're going to present it. And of course, also consider, I mean, one has to be empathetic, because, you know, one of the things that I try and do is take great care in the way in which I present material, because I want to try to bring my audience with me, not lose them.
Right.
And I think, you know, what Rick has succeeded in doing, without any question, is introducing, you know, if you like, a great tranche of people to a realm that exists outside of their perception of third dimensional reality. And, you know, my observation would be, you know, for those people who have got excited, become excited by Rick's work, and I'm sure, obviously, I mean, Rick would, you know, encourage those who have the interest and the motivation to pursue it further.
Yes.
But the nature of this game is not to necessarily suddenly, every time you find something new, stick it up on a blog. You know, the challenge here is to find information and integrate it into the bigger picture. Because otherwise what happens, what you've got is you've got, you know, people finding pieces of jigsaw, throwing all this jigsaw into the morass, and it's like you've got a 5,000-piece jigsaw. You've got no picture, but you've got a 5,000-piece jigsaw. And while you've just got that one set of 5,000 pieces in front of you, there's a chance that you can actually put that picture together, even though you haven't got the master picture. But then if somebody else comes along and empties on top of it another 5,000-piece jigsaw, and then somebody comes along and tips another 5,000-piece jigsaw, and then says, okay, your challenge is still to put the original picture together, it's really, really tough.
Yes.
Now, let me tell you that there's a whole lot of people out there working for, let's call them the away team, who are very definitely tipping 5,000-piece jigsaws on top of the main jigsaw. Because, you know, they have every intention of making it as difficult as possible for people to uncover, you know, what it is that they're doing.
Yeah.
That said, of course, we also, I'm sure we'll talk later, they're becoming more and more arrogant. And so once you do actually have that first picture together, you can actually see patterns, and then it becomes quite easy to put the other jigsaws together. And I think, you know, I would say that in the short time that, you know, Rick was, you know, with us in this physical realm, and the short time that, you know, he was doing this kind of research, he has undoubtedly, you know, made a very, very significant contribution, and obviously undoubtedly made a big impact. And, you know, I mean, in fact, I have incorporated some of his work into a couple of the presentations that I've done this year. And what's interesting as well, one of the things that I have to say is that, you know, one of the things that I've learned in the course of, you know, my research is that I don't have an original idea in my head. And even when I think I've come up with something original, I can pretty much guarantee that if I search, even for a relatively short time, I can find people that have come up with this stuff beforehand.
Yes.
And, you know, it's very evident that, you know, more and more people are tapping into this stuff. And I'll give you an example. I actually gave a presentation, I think, about the same time that you were talking to Rick. And I actually put in that presentation a slide, a PowerPoint slide, which showed the Mayan calendar rotating in each of the five rings. Now, at that time, I hadn't seen Rick's blog, and I'd had no contact with Rick. And then I saw it on his blog. You know, so there's a classic example of, you know, effectively us. I mean, it's not particularly, you know, totally revolutionary.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, nonetheless, it was a classic case of two of us coming up with, you know, a particular aspect at exactly the same moment.
Yes.
And I've had many, many experiences of that during the course of, you know, my research. And I'm sure, you know, many other people listening to you can relate to exactly the same thing.
Yes. And by the way, I think that the web kind of visualizes this almost in a way, if you will, because of the nature of the blogs that you were talking about, that as soon as people have one piece of the puzzle, that they're throwing it out there and people can, you know, nibble on it, so to speak, and pick up on it, or you know, expand it further or whatever. But this really kind of gives you almost like a real-time map, if you will, if one tracks, you know, all the blogs and so forth, of course. But this gives you like a real-time map of the human, you know, conscious in a way, or the overmind, if you will, in one way.
And of course, what we have seen here is a phenomenal revolution in the opportunity for consciousness to absorb this information. I mean, literally in the last, 20 years maximum. Because, you know, whereas before the advent of the web, you know, this research and integration of the information would have to be done the hard way, i.e. either, you know, by spending time at a library or in correspondence with people. I mean, now it's instantaneous. You know, and I think that, you know, most of the current generation of researchers would acknowledge that, you know, we could not have done what we do today 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't believe that it's any accident that, of course, we have access to the web at this time. You know, we have the irony, of course, the web has its shadow side. And, you know, that shadow side is that a statistic I saw earlier this year is that 90% of all non-business related activity on the web is related to pornography.
Yeah.
So that's the shadow side. And of course, Rick, you know, touched on that in his research. And, it, you know, likewise, I mean, this, I think, actually sort of also reflects the challenge that, you know, we all have to face today. And this is actually, you know, dealing with our shadow self. And
yes.
I mean, unfortunately, obviously, in sort of recent weeks and perhaps even months, you know, what Rick was clearly having some difficulty with is, you know, countering that part of him that, you know, wasn't able to integrate with this third dimensional reality. And unfortunately, ultimately, that's the part that, you know, won the day.
Yes. So do you think that there is a danger in one way there? Because, again, I'm not for the idea of you know, saying that, oh, you should be, you know, afraid of going into certain areas or what have you, but
with that
being said, I mean, do you think that there is a danger in that people have access to so much of this information so easily now? Is there a danger there?
Yes, there is a danger. I mean, of that there is no doubt. I mean, yeah, Rick, I am 10 years into this research now. You know, at 52, I mean, I enjoyed sort of close on 40 years totally locked into the third dimensional secular empirical material realm. Mm-hmm. The transition period for me was close on 5 years. And that was 5 years when, you know, I was not quite a recluse, but, you know, not far off. My cave was a boat on the canals in Amsterdam.
Right, right.
And, you know, I was able to hole up there and, you know, go through this process and integrate, you know, what it was that I was experiencing and what it was I was learning. I mean, in the course of my work, I've built up a library. I mean, I'm standing in my library now. I mean, it's a library of some 5,000 books. Mm. You know, because what I realized as I went through this transitory stage, this transpersonal process, if you like, you know, what I realized was that basically everything I thought I knew was wrong.
Yes.
And so I absolutely and unequivocally acknowledged that I had to completely re-educate myself. And most of that I've done through reading, research, and I mean, obviously, at the appropriate time, certain teachers have come my way and, you know, passed on their little tidbit of information, if you like, and then moved on, mm-hmm. You know, and that leads me to, you know, move forward, if you like, at my own pace. But I think, you know, in terms of if I look back, you know, in that transitory part of the process, you know, there was a very real danger. I mean, I absolutely understand paranoia.
Yes.
You know, and one of the reasons that I was almost deliberately putting myself into the sort of paranoid state was because I know that I'm not naturally paranoid and I wanted to understand what it was that was making me paranoid. So I was a glutton for punishment in that respect. Mm. And, you know, I certainly stared into the abyss and, you know, there was perhaps, you know, the odd occasion when I thought that I wasn't going to be able to find my way out. But, you know, I had the appropriate guides along the way, and I was given, you know, the, if you like, the map to help me find my way through. Yes. And it wasn't until, in fact, I can tell you that 9/11 was the absolute catalyst for me. And anybody that was traveling through Central America in the year 2001, if they were traveling through Belize and traveling through Plasencia, there's a very good possibility that they would have stopped off in a bar there called the Purple Space Monkey. And through much of the summer of 2001, I could be found propping up the bar there in the evening, having spent my day, you know, doing research. Mm. But I could be found propping up the bar. And one of the things that I was very adamant about at that time was that I was predicting that the US were about to create a major event to launch George Bush onto the world stage.
Mm.
Well, when 9/11 went down, as it happens, I was also scheduled to leave Belize, and I was on the first flight out of Belize after 9/11. But that was my trigger. That was what, if you like, was the catalyst to take me back into the real world. And I decided at that point that, you know, now was my time to come out of my cave, come out of my reclusion, and try and find a way to incorporate my newfound knowledge, hopefully apply some wisdom to that knowledge, and share what I learned, but find a way to share it so that, you know, I wasn't dismissed as, you know, a complete out and out crank. And as you now know, I mean, much of my work is spent literally at the front end of exposing the geopolitical agendas.
Yes.
And looking at the hard facts of that. And then part of my other work is looking at the more esoteric and occult aspects of what is occurring in the geopolitical realm. And there's no doubt in my mind that if somebody goes into this, you know, without a good foundation, then there's a number of ways in which they may come out of the journey, you know, without, how should I say, sufficient awareness to be able to understand how they are perceived within the wider community.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one example of this, of course, is David Shaler.
Right, right.
You know, who Rick also referenced, because Rick was also at the Glastonbury Symposium, because David Shaler was on platform immediately after me last year when David Shaler declared himself to be the reincarnation of the Messiah.
That is interesting, and, actually, in one way. Yes, okay.
So here is David, and David to this day is still adamant that he is the Messiah. Mm. You know, hey, well, that's another discussion.
Yes.
But, you know, Stuart Wilde, who I have a lot of respect for, and a lot of respect for the research that he has put together. And I mean, he himself has been through this process. And, you know, he identifies that, you know, one of the manifestations of this journey, if you don't properly integrate the process, is that you have this Messiah complex. He also identifies that another manifestation, if you don't, if you're not able to integrate the information and knowledge that you are accruing during this process, is suicide.
Hmm.
So, you know, there is no question that if you're coming into this realm of research and study, one has to acknowledge that it's a bit like a dangerous sport. And like any dangerous sport, if you train, you know, and if you go through the appropriate preparation, then it's not dangerous.
Right.
But if you go for shortcuts, then you basically you run the risk, obviously, of doing yourself a serious injury. I think another analogy, Henrik, is that let's equate this to, say, you know, learning something like a martial art.
Mm-hmm.
You don't become a black belt in 5 minutes.
Right, right, exactly.
You know, the body, the physical vehicle, you know, the emotion, the spiritual, the intellectual, all has to go through a process of learning and development, which is, you know, carefully structured and obviously follows a pattern that's been developed over, you know, probably a few millennia. And then it's only at, you know, some eventual juncture that a person becomes a black belt and then perhaps moves on to, you know, the various Dan grades, etc. Yes. And I think, you know, although we don't have any obviously formal structure to this process,
exactly.
And God forbid, that's not the purpose at all. But nonetheless, I mean, I think we have to be cognizant that, you know, this has to be taken at an appropriate pace.
Yes, I think you're right there, and I've talked with other friends about that as well. There isn't never going to be a structure within this, because again, this, if we even can call it a community or a research group or people that are interested in somewhat similar areas, this is not a school. This is not formal. It's not going to be structured in that way. And that means that you yourself are your only kind of in one way teacher and guide, if you will. You are the one who have to keep track on how much you're taking in and at what pace and what is, you know, good for you as a person, what you can deal with and so forth. My recipe, so to speak, for how to do this is on a very kind of human and a very basic level. I mentioned it before, but just the idea of kind of keeping a healthy kind of detachment from it, a balance, the importance of disconnecting from the subject matter, having a laugh, having a few drinks, as I said before, go out into nature and play, create and paint and draw, laugh, you know, that's my kind of recipe. What do you think, Ian?
I totally agree with you. I mean, you know, I'm very fortunate. I have a very supportive partner. I have my kids, I lead a normal life in that respect. But, you know, obviously once I step out of that normal life, I'm researching in realms that are considered anything but normal.
Yes.
Interestingly, I gave a presentation on the more mundane issue, actually, of the myth of peak oil, just a couple of days ago in the northwest of England. And this gentleman came up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, he said, Ian, I've been following your work, and this guy is in his 60s, and he said, I have been regarded as sick for the last 30 years. He said, I've been signed off work for 30 years. I receive benefit from, you know, the government because I can't work. And he said, and the only reason I can't work is because I was seeing everything that you're seeing 30 years ago. Hmm. And I couldn't adapt to working in society. So they tried to put me on antidepressants.
Oh, really?
You know, and he said, I fought that. He said, but, you know, what he notices now, fortunately, is that there are more and more people. And now he's part of a, you know, small community. They don't live together, but, you know, there's a group of friends, if you like,
who he
can relate to. And I think, you know, this is another part of keeping this in perspective. It's finding other people, whether it's individuals or within groups or whatever, who you can discuss these issues with. And in fact, I listened to a piece of the discussion you had with Neil Kramer, I think, last week.
Yes.
You know, and in that discussion, I think Neil mentioned that, you know, more and more people are finding it difficult to relate to the people that they work with or even their family.
Mm.
And there is no question. I mean, over the last few years, there have been a phenomenal increase in sort of divorces and separations as one partner taps into this this journey and the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
And so consequently, you know, they sort of move apart. But, you know, what is happening is people are finding, and I count myself very fortunate, you know, people are finding partners who they can carry on down this path with. And, you know, there's a mutually supportive relationship to enable this to progress. But so having that balance is very important. And it's also very important, I mean, to be comfortable with people so that, you know, if you do go off on a particular tangent or blind alley, that there's somebody there who can tell you that you're actually talking a load of bollocks.
Right. Yes.
and force you to sort of actually, you know, reflect on where you're at. To put it in perspective, I think, you know, it is very, very important that we do as much as possible to stay real.
Yes. Absolutely. Yep. And I think you're right there. I mean, just talking with someone about it, I mean, it's very, that's very important. And as you say, of course, there are those who are, you know, unfortunate that don't have that, you know, possibility, so to speak. People that are in one way or another are kind of isolated and feel that that's difficult. But again, I mean, it's all kinds of ways that you can do it now. You can do it online, search up people there. I mean, there's all kinds of ways these days to get some kind of contact, and it's very good to just talk and get it out. And it's to say you can bounce things back and forth as well with other people. You can, if you sit down and talk to yourself, in many cases, the person you're talking about talking with is actually like a mirror in a way, and what you're saying comes back to you. And you can hear if it's reasonable or not. So it's very healthy, exactly. You know.
Now on the other part of this, of course, and I mean we've not really sort of gone into it too much, but I mean the other part of this is it does go hand in glove, obviously, very much with the spiritual journey.
Yes.
And fortunately, again, you know, more and more people are, especially at this particular juncture, are tapping into this. And I think, you know, my own perception is that many, many, perhaps even millions of souls have returned to this physical realm at this juncture because of its significance. You know, when you think that just not even 100 years ago, the global population was estimated to be less than a billion people.
Mm.
And here we are now at nearly 7 billion.
Yes.
And it's like every soul that ever visited this third dimensional realm has returned at this point in time because, you know, of some significance, which, you know, although we might perceive we have an inkling of what that is, we don't really know.
Mm.
We don't really know. But, you know, fortunately, there are increasing you know, spiritually aware communities. And, you know, it is important, I think, to, again, to find perhaps a community that you can relate to, because one of the things that I will say, and I live in a community in the southwest of England that sort of considers itself to be, you know, the alternative capital of Europe. But, you know, I have to tell you, and I'm going to put this as tactlessly as I possibly can. But, you know, a lot of these people, they have their heads so far up their own arse. You know, I mean, they're of no help or whatever to man or beast.
Right.
And the other danger is that you get into this bullshit of sort of spiritual one-upmanship.
Hmm.
You know, and obviously this should be your first clue. And I mean, anybody who tells you they have all the answers, that should be your first clue to still steer well clear of them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Because we're here for one reason and one reason alone. That's because we are all perennial students. And our challenge, the challenge we set ourselves before we incarnated, was to use this opportunity to learn as much as we possibly can about ourselves, about the way in which, you know, we relate to this realm, and that we can integrate ourselves, you know, with the other realms, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
But, you know, it's a learning process.
Yes.
It's a learning process, you know, and it's very, very individual. But, you know, what is important is that at least when we do share with individuals, we can very quickly, hopefully, get away from the fact that we are individually in any way special.
Mm.
You know, and the reason I raise that is because I think Jung, you know, actually identified it very well, because, you know, he's clearly, I think, you know, we would acknowledge as the pioneer of the transpersonal process, or understanding the transpersonal process in the last sort of century or so.
Right.
And he identified that, you know, as one goes through this, you do come to a point where you actually believe that you are the chosen one.
Right.
And he called it the Yahweh syndrome. And he said that, you know, some people get through this sort of very, very quickly. I mean, I think in my own case, it was about 2.5 nanoseconds. But others, like David Shaler, you know, it takes a little bit longer. And I'm very sure that in 2 or 3 years, especially if he lays off the drugs, in 2 or 3 years or so, David Shaler will actually come to a realization that whilst he's had a very interesting experience, he's had a very interesting journey, he's not the Messiah.
Right.
You know, and in Jerusalem, they actually have a unit in the Israeli police that's called the Messiah unit.
Okay.
Because on average, they have about 14 people a year who, you know, they're visiting Jerusalem, and obviously they get caught up in the emotion, or they tap into the ether or whatever. They tap into something, obviously, while they're there. And they have this incredible urge to, in most cases, apparently, they take a sheet from the bedroom of the hotel where they're in, wrap themselves in the sheet, and they go out on the streets and, you know, preach. I mean, it's, you know, it's classic. It's an absolute classic, and it's a stage in the journey.
Sorry to interrupt you, but exactly, I think you're right, and it's important for people on the outside as well to be aware of that is a natural process, because as you say about the integration and so forth that Jung talks about, you know, that's not too widely known. You know, people don't know that's something that, you know, many people might go through sometimes when they're, you know, around 40 or whatever, you know, around 30, or some people have, you know, different stages in their life or different ages. But I believe it's a natural thing, a very healthy process in one way, because you know, the it depends also a little bit, the reaction, so to speak, of how that plays out is dependent on how you've lived your life up until that point. Meaning that if you're, you know, if you've been very strict or what have you, the other side might be flowing over and you're becoming more, you know, loose and soft, if you will, you know, or vice versa. So it's important that people know that just because one have these kinds of experiences, that doesn't, you know, discredit you totally or make you nuts. I think that one needs to go into that process as well with 100% certainty and really live it, really be in it to actually go through it, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, let's understand, in the West, we have this absurd term called the midlife crisis. You know, in the indigenous peoples, it's called the midlife opportunity.
Yes.
And, you know, in many of the indigenous peoples, you cannot be a candidate to be regarded as an elder unless you've been through this process. Mm. And you know, when they see the first signs of it, which, you know, is about, apparently it's about the same as in the West, you know, all of a sudden, the guy starts to comb his hair differently or, you know, dress differently, you know, put on the tight leather trousers or whatever. but whatever, when they see the signs that, you know, this is starting, that they feel like the Kundalini has been awakened, they have a place, and it's a cave, or it's a, you know, a remote hut or whatever, and they make sure that the individual is you know, appropriately supported, you know, with food, with water, with the elders coming to visit him, and he's encouraged to embrace the experience.
Yes.
You know, what do we do in the West? Give people Prozac or Xanax.
Yeah.
You know, or we say, you know, in the Britain, you know, it's like, come on, you know, get yourself out of it. you know, keep a stiff upper lip, man. And then when you hear people say, you know, oh, I've beaten the midlife crisis, because, you know, basically they're still doing what they've always been doing. They're still doing, you know, a 9-to-5 job, and they're still caught up in the financial slavery. No, they didn't beat the midlife crisis. The midlife crisis beat them.
Yeah, there you go.
the challenge, the real challenge here, and unfortunately, of course, you know, the Western society is all about shutting down that. In fact, in the presentation I gave at this year's Glastonbury, which was called The War on Terror, TERRA, The War on Earth, the subtitle was Bio-Spiritual Warfare. You know, because more and more people, and I think, you know, Rick is a classic example, are having this, how should I say, this awakening earlier and earlier in life. I mean, you know, nearly 100 years ago, Rudolf Steiner wrote, he said, you know, anybody who goes into this process before the age of 40 is not ready.
Right.
Now, you know, he wrote that in 1908, or said that in a lecture in 1908. But that's not the case today. And I mean, I think there's no question in my mind that some of the children that are being born today are actually, you know, being born into the world with a phenomenal level of awareness.
Yes.
And I mean, I see this in, you know, some of the children that, you know, my kids associate with. And I think our challenge as parents is to help them realize their full potential, you know, not to try and sort of shut them down because they're different.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. It's horrible how we also have, as you said, we've suppressed the idea of you know, the midlife crisis as we call it up here, you know, in that regard. And definitely it's the other way around. This is something that is very unhealthy to suppress that. This just should be encouraged and really so people can, you know, bloom out, so to speak, and come to their full potential. And And I agree with you as well. I think that more and more, you know, younger people are going through this faster and faster. I mean, we could even look at this speed up process that is going on up towards, you know, 2012 or whatever we want to look way beyond that, where information is accumulating, you know, knowledge is accumulating. There's more and more, and it's going faster and faster. So a consequence of that is that when people come to this earth and when we grow up, we're gonna realize things much faster. In one way, it's very kind of logical if you think about it, because the nature of how much we are, you know, how much we're involved with so early at the stages of our lives, so that you know, by the time you're, you know, 25 or 20 in some cases, or 30 at this point, you might have gone through as much as someone who, you know, did when they were 40 or 50, living, you know, 50 years ago or something like that, you know.
I think that's a very sound observation. And I mean, just to put some practicalities on this, you know, I mean, there are obviously now some very, very good books that, you know, I'm only going to sort of recommend a couple, but and obviously, you know, people can research it for themselves and go where they feel. I mean, obviously in the West, we demonize drugs.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you know, we also know that you know, the governments are actually probably definitely the largest suppliers of these drugs, for reasons that we don't have time to go into right now.
The chemical compounds, at least, yes.
Particularly the chemical compounds, exactly, the synthetics. And there's no question that the synthetics have a far higher risk factor than the natural substances. You know, so if anybody is tempted to sort of go down the path of, you know, the shamanic journey, then, you know, seriously consider what's available legally and naturally.
Yeah.
You know, because that is a far better route. And yes. But of course, I mean, the big difference is that in the West, we have no preparation within our culture for shamanic practices. And, you know, one of the things that I will observe, Henrik, is that one of the things I'm absolutely convinced of in the course of my research is that the vast majority of people who supposedly die of a drug overdose do not die from the pharmacology.
Hmm.
What they die from is fright. Now, really? which brings on a coronary. So, you know, basically it's the same effect perhaps as the pharmacology. But if we look at the evidence, the medical evidence that was conducted back in the 1920s, particularly with heroin, and even back then it was acknowledged that, you know, depending on the individual, depending on how much heroin they could be injected with or they could consume before it had any kind of effect on them whatsoever. But what was most significant was, you know, where it took them in terms of, you know, the tear in the veil into the other realms.
Mm.
And of course, in the indigenous peoples, you know, nobody was allowed to participate in the shamanic practice until they'd been through the appropriate education.
Right.
But of course, we don't have that in the West, and people go into it thinking that it's all going to be, you know, wonderful, and they're going to have this really sort of chilled experience, when in reality, where they go, they have no preparation for, and basically, they're scared shitless, and that brings on the coronary.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the best research work on, you know, shamanic experiences actually dates, again, right back to the sort of probably early part of the 20th century, before there was all the conditioning, when research was genuine. But one of the best books is probably Flesh of the Gods, by which is a compilation by Peter First.
Mm-hmm.
He draws a lot on the work of R. Gordon Wasson, who was a very interesting guy, because you know, he had some very, very interesting shamanic experiences. But in later life, he actually came to be the chairman, I think it was, of the Morgan Stanley Bank. So there was an interesting journey. But for anybody that you know, really wants to have a look at the real dangers, current dangers of chemical drug abuse, there's one book that I very highly recommend. It's called In Place of the Self, and the subtitle is How Drugs Work. And it's written by a guy called Ron Dunselman, which is spelled Dunselman. And he worked with the Dutch drug agency or drug support agency, Jelinek. And this was research done over some 20 odd years or so. But in that, he looks at the really negative potentials of journeying into the shamanic realms without the appropriate preparation. Mm. And I think one of your previous speakers or interviewees touched on this, because one of the results would seem to be that we open up the pathway for disincarnate entities to actually start to interfere with our physical experience.
Hmm. Yes.
And obviously that can be a rather disconcerting experience,
to
say the least.
Absolutely, and it's very interesting as well. I've been kind of looking into that. I think it's definitely a real possibility. I believe that this can happen with all kinds of drugs. I've always had this idea with alcohol, at least, that
absolutely.
When some people really black out, there's something else that's coming into that body and taking over the processes. And in many cases, it's an evil bastard too,
Well, you're absolutely right. And let me share something with you here. This was some research that I was involved in some time ago. With the alcohol experience, again, you have a situation, particularly with people who drink quite heavily regularly. And interesting enough, in some cases, what you find is that instead of their tolerance increasing, their tolerance decreases. And what tends to happen is when they go to the blackout, they sort of look as though they're starting to sort of drop off to sleep. They look as though they're starting to fade out. Mm. But then all of a sudden they bounce back and it's like, well, hello there. I'm ready to party. Yet the following day, they have no recollection of that at all.
Yeah.
And the hypothesis that we came up with, funnily enough, you'll never see this in any academic work, because most of the people involved in this needed to look after their funding.
Yep.
So I won't divulge any of the players who were involved here. Mm. But the hypothesis that we worked with was that when these people were blacking out, their higher self was not doing its job, which is to protect the soul that is incarnated in the physical vehicle. And disincarnate entities were literally coming in and taking temporary possession of the physical vehicle.
Mm.
And one of the, you say, okay, well, what's the evidence for this? Well, one interesting piece of evidence is, I'm sure you've heard of the phenomena that, when people are seriously drunk and they fall over, they don't hurt themselves. Well, one of the theories that we put forward was that one of the universal laws of this temporary possession is that the physical vehicle has to be handed back in the same condition in which it was borrowed.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Of course it sounds outrageous, but just think it through.
Yeah.
It sounds outrageous because it's beyond the bounds of our current educational process in this sort of third dimensional realm.
Mm.
So the physical vehicle is then sort of handed back the next day or whatever, later that evening. The person sort of sleeps it off, wakes up, and absolutely has zero recollection of the latter part of the night. The last thing they remember is actually sort of losing consciousness in the early part of the night.
Mm.
And of course, this actually also only tends to happen in places where there's a lot of people drinking.
Right.
It doesn't happen, as far as we know, as far as we could ascertain, it doesn't happen when people are drinking alone. When they drink alone, they drink, they get drunk, they fall down.
Mm.
They go to sleep, they wake up, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're in a club or a pub, so it's almost as though that you've got these disincarnate entities that are hanging around waiting for this opportunity to enjoy a temporary ownership, and then they can sort of carry on with the physical experience. It's almost like they've left the physical realm, but they've still got too much attachment to it, and so they won't go all the way over to the light.
Hmm. That's interesting.
So your observation is absolutely sound. We do have to be careful with alcohol as well as drugs.
Absolutely. I'm thinking of all these, many cases, very old bars, the old inns, part of very old buildings. And who knows, some of these fellas might be hanging around there, just waiting to get the get-go to jump in and take over and have a good ride, as it were, for a couple of hours, you know, freak people out, what have you. Wow.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, consequently, I think, you know, normally one of the things that one of the manifestations, if you like, of the of people going through the process is, one, they will be moderate at best or worst, whichever way you look at it, in their usage of anything, whether it's drugs or alcohol, that might actually open them up to this temporary possession.